Welcome to American Tributaries Podcast, where to help get out of the bubbles we've all been stuck in for the last few years, we're exploring the various currents of people in our country using modern technology, kind of like a 21st century Lewis and Clark journey. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Deborah Bass. We both went to school at the University of Pennsylvania, but more recently became connected over our common affection for wine. Deborah lives in the Los Angeles area and is a research scientist for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratories. Deborah, thank you so much for joining me today. And I know you are a lot more than a research scientist, but I didn't know which of those roles actually was the best description. But thank you again. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful, sunny, warm day in Southern California. And as ever, I feel very fortunate to get to live here and work here.
How long have you been in the LA area?
Let's see. So this current time, we moved back. My husband and I moved from San Antonio, Texas, to the northern Los Angeles area back in 2001. That was after a four-year stint while he was stationed at Wilford Hall Medical Center at Lackland Air Force Base. Okay. He is retired military Air Force. So that was the reason we went to San Antonio. But before that, we were both in California. We met in California, where I was in school and he was doing some work for the Air Force down at LA Air Force Base. So since, I guess I've been in Los Angeles with that little asterisk in the middle of 4 years, since 1997. Is that right? No, I've been in California since 1992 when I graduated from Penn.
Okay. And you studied geology at Penn, is that correct?
I did. I was one of three geology majors at the University of Pennsylvania in my year. Clearly not a significant center of the kind of geology that I was thinking about pursuing. I wanted to do planetary geology, which is the geology of other planets. But that is not something that Penn is associated with, really. So I was fortunate enough to have a professor who was open to an independent study with me. Penn is known for paleontology and mineralogy, which are two subspecialties of geology. But it all worked out for me. I've been incredibly fortunate to have mentors and others who would help me along my path.
So at that point, I mean, obviously, if I recall correctly, and I wasn't in engineering or science, but I mean, you know, there was largely a male dominated I guess practice back then, but you also had the other obstacle, the fact that you weren't from, I guess, one of like the preeminent, like, you know, I guess, planetary geology schools. So how did you decide that that's what you wanted to do, given that that wasn't like the school's specialty? And how did you actually kind of propel yourself into this profession despite the obstacles that you must have faced?
So that's interesting, because you're right. There are, at the time, there were not very many women in geology, nor in planetary science, et cetera. I had a teaching assistant who was female, and she was a great inspiration to me, because she was, frankly, quite attractive, and she liked nice jewelry, which is something I like too. And so I thought, if there's room for her in this field, then there's room for me. So modeling, so seeing that representation, I suppose, is the term we use now. Representation really does matter. And that's something I have tried to do as I've moved through my career, is to show folks that if you really want to do something it's possible, and having mm-hmm. someone else who you can see doing that same thing is so, so useful. So I kind of thought, I love big picture things. Mm-hmm. And in high school, my favorite topics in school were English and history. Mm-hmm. My family, however, is all about medicine and healthcare. Mm-hmm. So I was supposed to be a physician. my father was a physician. My older sister is a pediatrician. My grandfather was a pharmacist. My mom's a social worker. Mm-hmm. She's retired now. So that's what I started mm-hmm. college in, was as a biology major. And in fact, I didn't declare my major in geology until my senior year, because I was too afraid to tell my parents what I wanted to do. And I just loved reading the history in the rocks. That's what geology is. It's a story that's written in the landscape. And so because of that, it just really spoke to me. I just really loved this way of telling stories through the physical landscape. So I did that, but then I discovered that that one could do extraterrestrial geology. And that was compelling to me because I always loved science fiction growing up. But I thought that to work in space, you had to be an astronomer. And for me, astronomy was not all that interesting. It's about stars and galaxies, etc. But it's like big balls of gas. And I like rocks and tangible things, things you can touch. So for me, when I learned that there was a way for me to marry the science fiction with the science and the geology, I thought, home run, that's what I want to do. So then it was a matter of convincing my parents that I wasn't going to be living in their basement for the rest of my life. Of course, in California, we don't really have basements, but you know, their spare room or whatever. So they were not happy with me when I said I wanted to not only declare as a geology major, but I wanted to go get a PhD in geology. And they thought that that was just crazy. We had a family friend who had just graduated with a PhD in geology, and she indeed was living back at home. So my parents were quite unhappy with that notion. But, you know, I think it's kind of worked out at this point. So I did a couple of projects with a NASA Field Center, Ames Research Center, which is up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that's where I came from. And that one thing led to another, and I got a recommendation for graduate school, and it kind of went from there. And it's been an amazing ride and a fantastic opportunity for me. That's for sure.
And so it seems interesting to me that you wanted to get into a profession, into a study or a practice that was about some touching things, but yet you the things that you're studying are things that you probably will never touch, actually.
that's true, but that actually that's interesting because so I just started a new assignment at work, and I'm working on Mars sample return. And so we've started that campaign at NASA, and it is a multi-mission, multi-decade activity or campaign of exploration. The culmination of which is bringing the samples back to Earth from Mars and putting them in a laboratory and getting to study them, looking for evidence of present or past life. And that is the thing that I find the most compelling. So we have not, first of all, humans have not landed on Mars. And secondly, we have not brought samples back from Mars. We do have Mars meteorites. So they're pieces of rock that have come off of the surface of Mars have spent time in space getting sterilized and blasted by cosmic rays, and then come through the Earth's atmosphere, getting burned in the atmospheric deceleration. And so they get kind of a molten crust on the top of them, and then landing on Earth. So we do have some Mars rocks that have come to Earth, but we haven't picked those rocks. And it appears that most of those rocks come from a similar place on Mars. So they have very similar character. And what we know from the orbital measurements that we've done of Mars' surface, as well as the landed vehicles that have roamed around the surface of Mars, that there are many different terrains, many different kinds of geology that we see on Mars. And so the fact that the Mars rocks, the meteorites, represent a very similar character implies that they're probably from one or two locations. And so there's a lot of diversity of the terrain that we have yet to explore in person, or we've yet to handle those kinds of rocks. So that's the main thing I'm interested in. So yes, someday, hopefully in 2033, I think is the current date, we'll be able to, I'll be able to maybe handle some of those rocks myself.
Wow, that would be such a thrill, I'm sure. What's the coolest thing? I wish I had a more scientific term, but like, what's the coolest thing you've actually like touched, whether an asteroid or like, I've gone to like the Museum of Natural History and they'll have like these like things that have come down to Earth, and like you see it, or maybe you get to touch it, and it's always interesting, but it strikes me that it could just be kind of like, I don't know, some kind of like weird, like kind of like metallic art or something. So I wish I knew more about what I was actually seeing or touching, but like from your viewpoint, what are some things where you're like, I just can't believe I'm touching this.
So I typically work in a much more theoretical space, and I like the early stages of a project. So I am not, I would say, a research scientist very much these mm-hmm. days. I'm a scientist. I'll always be a scientist because that's the way I think about life, the universe, and everything in it. I like to develop an hypothesis and then test it with evidence and see what fits and see what doesn't fit. I'm a frightening researcher in terms of when it comes to buying a new refrigerator or something. I will do a lot of, as we say, deep dives into a lot of technical material. So touching stuff is not really what I do anymore these days. I've moved pretty much into management of projects and people. So the mission I'm working on currently is a mission called Psyche, and it is scheduled to launch this August, in fact, to an asteroid. I'll try that again. The mission I'm working on currently, which is scheduled to launch in August, is a mission to an asteroid called Psyche 16. And that asteroid is what looks like the core of a planet. So the asteroid belt are the rocks between Mars and Jupiter. And so it's not the comets that are coming from way out in the solar system. These are rocks that stay in an orbital path between Mars and Jupiter. And we believe they are pieces of planetary bodies that never coalesced into another planet, for example, or maybe got pulled apart. So what we see is there's some pieces that represent the outside of our planet. There are pieces that represent the middle of a planet, like the mantle. So we've got crust, We've got Mantle, and NASA has visited, and some other space agencies as well have visited some of those asteroids and mapped them and taken readings of them to figure out what they're all about. But what we haven't done is gone to a metal asteroid, something that looks like the core of our planet. So it has iron and nickel and magnesium. And since we can't actually touch or go to the core of our planet, too deep and too hot and too under pressure, it's kind of neat to be able to go to an asteroid and see what we can understand about our solar system from that perspective. And that's that mission Psyche that I'm working on.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And Deborah, I know we had talked before, and I'd mentioned to you, what you're working on reminds me of, like, I guess when I think back to my time in the Navy, and I had mentioned to you when I watched Top Gun, I'm probably the only person in humanity that will tear up at the beginning of Top Gun, probably tear up at any point in Top Gun. But the reason why is when I watched that opening scene of, like, you know, flight operations in the morning, if you're a civilian, you see, you know, fuel handlers and you'll see the airplanes. But, like, what I see is not just them, but it's everybody that's supporting those operations. And it's not just about a few pilots or, you know, or even fuel handlers, but people like signaling the airplanes. It's the quartermasters, it's the navigators, it's the engine guys. It's a team of, you know, 5,000 and even beyond the ship, who are all supporting those operations. And it makes me see how I appreciate how connected we all are. And it's easy to kind of lose sight of that, especially when we're in this world where you can just kind of connect to whatever you're interested in and stay in your bubble and never get out of it. But I can't even imagine how complicated it must be to do what you're doing. So, like, what's the team like for that kind of an operation? It seems unfathomable to me.
So you're right. The space missions that I've worked on, I used to think that the human body, coming as I do from the medical side of things, I used to think that the human body was the most complicated system of systems. And then I met spacecraft. And it is phenomenal how many things have to go right to make something like this work. And so right now we're in a phase of the Psyche mission called ATLO. It's assembly, test, and launch opportunity, ATLO. And so that's the time when we assemble and test the spacecraft. And then we break it all down and we load it onto a truck and we ship it, we drive it to Florida at Kennedy Space Center for launch. And then we reassemble it and do all the testing a second time so that it is ready to be launched. So this launch in August is what we're like racing to. And we have a launch window that we have to meet. So we have a deadline. And if we miss that deadline, we have other chances, but it means we have to keep the team assembled to keep working, and that costs it's a big investment. So we're trying very hard to meet our deadline. So the team is made up of scientists who thought of the ideas and are paying attention to how things are assembled, because the way they're assembled influences how well or poor the measurements we will get from the instrumentation, from the spacecraft. Then we've got all of the engineers who are working to understand how the interplanetary trajectories are going to work to get us from here to there. And then we have the folks who are actually assembling all the hardware. We have the technicians on the floor doing the cabling, because all of the data cables and the energy cables. We have folks who are doing all the thermal blankets and who wire the heaters for the spacecraft, because it's pretty darn cold in space. We have technicians who are machining the parts, and we want to make sure that we use the right units. We don't want to use English units if we're working in metric and vice versa, and the fittings. And sometimes we get something we'll call FOD, which is foreign object debris, because in NASA, everything has to be an acronym. So, you know, it takes so many people. And on my side of the mission, we have our folks who are building the hardware and the software to test and to interface with the spacecraft. So to pull the data and then bring it up in some kind of display so that the team can understand what the spacecraft is signaling and whether we're hearing the telecom properly, et cetera. And our software and ground data system, as we call them, our GDS, another acronym, our ground data system folks are working with the ATLO team around the clock to make sure that the ground systems are not causing a holdup. Because again, we have to make that deadline of August to get launched. So the whole team is phenomenal, and it's exhausting work because it literally is 24/7 right now working to get to our launch window. And that is amazing to me because these folks are doing their job, and without it, we need everybody pulling in the same direction. And it is really easy sometimes to lose sight of why we're doing these things or why we're missing yet another holiday with our family or another birthday celebration or anniversary or what have you. But without each person doing their job, we would fail. It is so important that everyone keeps going and is at their best and is trying as hard as they can to make us all succeed. And because of that, it's again why I feel so, so fortunate to get to participate in something that's really bigger than myself. It's something that I hope will be in the history books one day. And that, for me, is a very motivating rationale for doing what I'm doing.
Wow. And where do you fall in? I guess how many people are involved like in the Psyche mission, and where do you fall exactly in like that whole like construct?
So NASA runs pretty hierarchically. It's kind of old fashioned in that sense. It's not a flat organization. And in this particular space mission, there's, I think, at JPL, there's probably about 200 people working on this mission. We are working with a spacecraft contractor up in Palo Alto, California, called Maxar. Used to be SSL, Space Science Labs, but they're now a subsidiary of Maxar. And I think there's probably another 200-300 people there. Plus, there's a team of scientists around the world, in fact, who we're working with. So I would say all told, there's probably around between 600 and 700 people working on this mission. My particular area is the mission system. So I work on the ground side. So we operate the spacecraft after it's launched, and we work to build up the system to figure out how to operate it before launch. So we are the people, processes, and ground tools for operations. And my team is about 60 some odd people, I would say. And I have a team of about 7 or 8 direct reports. So people that I interface with directly, and then all of those people have teams that work with them. So like I said, it's pretty hierarchical. And I am one of 4 system managers on my project. And then we're run by a project manager and a principal investigator.
Wow. And, you know, it's I'm thinking about how you're talking about the truck that's got to take the everything to Florida, and just thinking about how big the team is and how reliant you are. I'm thinking like that truck driver seems to have a lot of responsibility as he or she goes across the country.
Exactly. There, everyone has so much responsibility, and it's really quite remarkable that these things work mm-hmm. at all. Yeah. I mean, what if that truck driver has a flat tire, you know, or has a, God forbid, an accident on the way and we miss that launch window? That would be very upsetting, obviously. You know, it takes everyone to make this work properly. Each person feels deeply about the commitment they have to the project.
It's one of the things that it took me a while to, I guess, appreciate. And I've seen the difference in the civilian world versus the military. Like, I was in the Navy, you know, straight out of college from 93 to 97, is, I guess, that idea of kind of working for something greater. One of the things that strikes me, like, now, even kind of coming out of this pandemic, is I think in like the civilian world, there really isn't, leadership seems to be not about getting people motivated to do something bigger than themselves. It's about, like, you know, this is a task, this is a project, this is your salary, your bonus. And there's really, I don't see very many places where people are actually motivated to do something bigger, even if it's just for the company, much less to contribute to the greater good. So when I see people hesitating about going back to work, to me, what I realize is like the civilian world, the corporate world, to me, doesn't really motivate people doing something for something greater than yourself. It's all just about its pay, and that's fine. But from what you're doing, or like what I did when I was in the Navy, it's you're motivated to either, you know, sacrifice for your family. You're motivated to kind of do whatever you can to explore like the unknown, and it's not with pay. You're not told, hey, you're going to get paid this much extra, or you're going to get stock options if we pull this off. You're doing it for something greater. And like military, you're doing it to serve your country. And for you, you're doing it for that, but also really serving humanity, it seems.
I'm very motivated by making the world a better place. And I feel that my part in making the world a better place is to increase the knowledge of our solar system, of our universe, and thereby understanding our place within it. And so I feel very small, and only I see how little we all are relative to that big blue marble and to the rest of humanity. But I find that working for something more than just my paycheck is a reason to get up in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And is this what you expected? I mean, as far as like kind of feeling this motivated, do you still have that? Is this the same kind of motivation and curiosity you had when you first got started? Or are you kind of surprised that you have this feeling, or that you have this feeling like 20, 30 years after you first, you know, embarked on this journey?
I will say that each mission that I've been fortunate enough to work on has had a different perspective on each one. I will say that the very first missions I worked on, which were the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, actually that's not true. I worked on the Spirit and Opportunities. They were the first missions I worked on when I came to JPL, when I was a postdoc in Texas at Southwest Research Institute. I worked on the Cassini mission to Saturn. But the one that I really took into my heart and into my soul were Spirit and Opportunity. And when I left there, when I moved onto a new assignment still at JPL, that was hard. I felt like I was leaving part of my family, because I'd worked overnights with these people and I had gotten to know their little tics and quirks and, you know, who likes only cold caffeine, even in 3 a.m, or who likes, you know, an extra popsicle or whatever, all those things that you learn about your family, your coworkers. that was hard to leave. So for a while, I kind of took a little bit of a dip in my enthusiasm because I was sad. I think I was mourning leaving my first mission. And now I've learned that that's the cycle of how these things are. And you meet some of the people that you worked with in different capacities. NASA's, quote, a small place. People take different responsibilities, and yet you know them and you know how they work. And that's useful. So I think I am differently motivated than I was in the beginning, but I still haven't lost all of that gee whiz amazement for getting to participate in this set of experiences, I suppose.
And when given how much work you have to do, what do you and I guess your family do to kind of decompress when you do get time off?
So I have this really bipolar kind of existence, I suppose. Maybe that's not a good way to put it. I have a very dual life. I live quite far from where I work. I live 51.7 miles one way from JPL. And so that's an hour drive one way to work. So, and I've done that for 20 years. The pandemic has left me in my home office for the last 2 years. And frankly, I recognize how lucky I am to get to work from home and not have had to go out. But the reason we live so far from where I work is that we have a pretty rural house and a pretty rural existence. So we have animals up the wazoo at my house. We have chickens and 3 dogs, 2 cats, 3 chinchillas, 2 horses. So when I'm not working, I'm in my grubby clothes and I'm dealing with my horse and my daughter's horse and all of our farm animals. And we live amongst avocado and citrus orchards, and it's very idyllic out here and is absolutely worth the drive to wake up in the morning and get to see this. So we spend a lot of time with our animals. Mm-hmm. In fact, yesterday, one of my daughters and I, we went on a big hike. It was like I think it was a 5 mile. It wasn't that long, but it was a lot of elevation change, 5 mile hike. And it was straight out the backyard. So that's the fun part, is to be able to do something like that. And we took one of the dogs, the one who's the easiest, around, off leash and around other people. So he was fun to take. He's our German Shepherd. And so, yeah, we have a fabulous, fabulous, place that we live in out here. We have an acre, with a barn on it and so forth. So wow. Lots of fun.
Sounds very different than the 2-bedroom apartment that I have in Brooklyn.
Oh my gosh. For the you five have all of those us. Kids and you have a 2-bedroom apartment? Really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I feel sorry for your daughter, Miranda. Where does she end up?
So she's the only one that has, she got the office that got converted into a bedroom, but she has no windows, which she lets us know about all the time. But she also is the only one with her own room and with her own closet, which we let her know about all the time.
That's hilarious. So at JPL, you say that you've arrived when you get walls and windows, okay? Because office space is at a premium on our campus also. And so most folks work in cubes. So getting a wall or a door that actually, you know, controls sound. That's a huge win. And then if you get Windows 2, man, you know, you're like on your way.
Well,
Miranda's coming.
She's got a wall. She lobbies. She tries to like Jedi mind trick her two brothers into giving up their room, but they're the ones with the windows. And I'm like, we're not putting two children into a room without windows with a big glass. She got like frosted glass doors that kind of wall her off from the living room. So
nice. You know,
it is what it is. We moved into a great neighborhood, but it's like 20 years ago. It's become too expensive for us to move for the time being, but it's a great area. And we kind of like, you know, we get by. We do have a hamster. That's the only animal we have.
That is hilarious. That is so funny. Yeah, we couldn't live that way, I have to say. The tax is that I work, you know, 50 miles away from where I live. So that was the choice we made. And certainly in the weather that you have on the East Coast, that would be almost impossible, I could imagine. So, you know, but we all make choices.
Yeah.
And these are the choices that I've made. I'll tell you that it has been fantastic to not have to do that drive every day for the last 2 years. I've gotten 10 hours a week back in my life, and that's pretty fantastic. I did once do a calculation of how many hours I'd spent on the road over the 20 years that I've been at JPL. That was not a good number. It was over a year of 24-hour days. Ooh. That I've been, you know, on the road or in that equivalent. Only one accident, I have to say. And that's when someone sideswiped me. So I've been really, really lucky. Even with spending all that time on the road.
Yeah. And is the offices that you work in, is that just in the middle of an office area, or does that have to be like in a secluded, like you don't launch aircraft from where you are. You're just doing all the development and construction and stuff.
My office space at JPL is just a part of a cube farm. So a normal office building with conference rooms and computers, you know, laptops that everybody brings wherever they go. So it's pretty standard. We do have clean rooms at JPL, and the ATLO team that I mentioned earlier works in those clean rooms with the hardware to assemble everything. I go visit. I can look through the visitors gallery and peer through the window. But nobody lets me on the floor because I don't have the credentials. I'm not certified to touch hardware. We do a whole bunch of different classes and training to be able to touch the hardware, because you don't want to have, say, you know, on a dry day and you touch, you sort of are sloughing your feet across the ground, and then you touch something and you get a little shock. That little shock could short out an entire circuit board in a clean room. So you don't want to do that, because these are not like the things that you can order up from Amazon or wherever. These are specially made, low volume, expensive pieces of hardware, because we just don't make them in mass quantities. So there's a lot of training to make sure that you're safe around the hardware. And I am not one of those people. What we do, though, is we're setting up our mission support area, or MSA, again, another acronym. And that's where we have the bigger workstations that can read all the data and the big databases behind collecting the data and trying to publish it and show it to the various scientists and engineers to make sure the systems are all working properly. Mm-hmm. So we're in the process. We did our first practice of the launch activities just last week, in fact, and that went quite well. Things we found out, you know, mistakes and stuff, but that's why you do these things. That's why you practice, is to learn from what you've done. So it went pretty well.
Do you get to go to the launch in Florida?
Yes, I think I will be going to the launch in Florida. I think that my family also may be coming. We've actually never seen a launch after all these years. Seems like Florida is a funny place to launch from because of the late afternoon thunderstorms in the summer, and it's not the weather doesn't always cooperate in Florida, because you need a clear day. You want to make sure that your spacecraft isn't blown off course or something weird happening. So you need it to be pretty still to be able to launch. The reason, though, that we typically launch from Florida is that we want to take advantage of the Earth's orbit. So we want to go with the orbital, with the direction of the orbit. And so that we fly, so that we can slingshot kind of around the Earth and use that gravity to assist us, a push. And so we launch over the ocean. And what we want to be certain is that if we have what we call a bad day, we don't talk about it anything other than that. if we have a bad day, we'll have the bad day over the ocean, not over populated centers, over the U.S. or over some other country. So we launch purposefully over the ocean. And that's why there's not that many interplanetary launches from the West Coast, because then you would be flying all the way across the U.S. And that's a higher risk. And we have to be careful, of course, with the public's trust in us.
Yeah. How old is the technology that you're working with? Like, I remember when I was in the Navy, like one of the challenges when they're coming up with like, you know, new types of cruisers or aircraft is that you start working on it. And like in the 1970s, you might be using cutting edge 1973 technology, but by the time it's actually, you know, you get the funding, you develop it, and it's actually out there, the technology might be 10 years old or more. I don't know the numbers, but you definitely know there's a lag. So like for you, how old is the technology that you're working with? And is there a way to kind of stay current? Or is it just kind of like, look, this is what we had 5 years ago when this started, and we're stuck with it?
So 5 years ago doesn't feel like that long in the space game, that's for sure. Given how long it takes for these things to come together. This mission, Psyche, has some brand new technology. We're using an ion propulsion system instead of a chemical propulsion system. So we're using things called Hall thrusters. And what we're doing is, so the way a chemical propulsion mission works is that there's a lot of coasting once you're in space. And every now and again, you burn fuel like crazy to get to correct for sort of a drift. So there's always a drift, okay? And so with a chemical propulsion, you'll then burn and get back onto the right trajectory. With an ion propulsion, or what we call low thrust mission, we're constantly propulsing. We're burning a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit of fuel, ions that are converted from solar panels, all the time. So we're constantly correcting our motion, but we don't go very far with each little correction. But it requires sort of paying attention all the time and flying the spacecraft kind of all the time. So that is, there's haven't been that many deep space missions that have used ion propulsion. That's relatively new. There was a spacecraft, Dawn, which went to the Ceres and Vesta asteroids, and they were also ion propulsion missions. But these Hall thrusters are brand new. It's a different kind of ion propulsion. So that's new. The other thing that's very exciting is that we've got a technology demonstration on this mission, Psyche, called the Deep Space Optical Communication, DSOC. Another acronym. And DSOC is slated to see how much data we can push down an optical path. So normally when we communicate, we use radio waves. This one is going to use space lasers, literally to transmit data. So we're trying to, so the first year of our mission, every week we are going to be interfacing with some telescopes on Earth and having DSOC send information, command DSOC through the uplink channel, as we call it, and then send data back through the downlink channel to the downlink pass. And the goal of that is, or the reason to do that is because you can send a huge, a heck of a lot more data through the optical pathway than you can through a radio wave. And what we're hoping is that we can, quote, increase the bandwidth enough so that at Mars, if we do send humans to Mars, we'll have a much more robust, a much larger volume of data that we can get back and forth from Mars to Earth. So we're working with DSOC to, this will be the first demonstration of this pathway at these distances. So that's going to be fun.
I mean, how far, like how much are you able to test that kind of a system before you kind of have your whole mission depend upon it?
So because this is a technology demonstration, it's totally separate. We're just carrying the payload, carrying their radio, optical radio. So we are not dependent upon it at all. We're just going to demonstrate whether the technology can work. And after that, I expect that there will be additional missions that try out or use this as a pathway. I don't know how long it's going to take before we're actually able to use this as a regular pathway, but this is the first step on getting to that point.
So I had asked you about the Martian, the movie, and about how realistic it was. But I was thinking, like, I know, like, for me, you know, once I'm in like the wine profession, you kind of see a lot of things and you see like pop culture references to wine and like, and you certainly will see it's a bit superficial or not too accurate or, you know, too simplistic. For you, since we were talking about Mars, did you find that the book or the movie, whatever you may have read or been exposed to, was like an accurate description of like what could be at least feasibly possible? Did it seem way too outlandish? And just like in general, like what are your favorite like space movies? I don't know if you watch them, but if you do, like what are some where you just think that this is a great representation that certainly seems possible?
I loved that movie and the book, The Martian. I watched the movie, I think, 3 or 4 times, and I read the book first. There were some things that were a little, there were some liberties taken for drama, but in general, much of what they showed was pretty darn accurate. And that was part of the reason I loved it so much, was that it was able to marry the science with the fiction and do that so well. I will say that one of the movies that I have really appreciated, space movies, was Contact. And mostly the part that I liked was the view of the scientist who was working to talk to the Jodie Foster character, who had a sort of a pure vision of what science should be. And she was up against another scientist who was very clever. I cannot recall his name or who the actor was, but he was able to work the politics of science and of funding and so forth. And that is actually an extremely accurate portrayal of how big science really works, and that you can't ignore the funding sources and you have to be cognizant of the politics that are at play in order to be very successful. I think that a lot of scientists, a lot of people don't realize that you have to kind of play the game also to be successful. And it's kind of disappointing, I think, for some folks to realize that that understanding people and understanding people's motivations is important in every profession, and that you can't divorce the human from the science or from the job, and that communicating, talking to other people is so important in every aspect of our existence. And I feel really strongly that you have to pay attention to that, as well as the kernel of what motivates you to do what you do. The outside parts, the talking to other people and helping them understand and helping you understand them, that's just being alive. And that's the only way to go.
Yeah, that's what I really admire Neil deGrasse Tyson in terms of how he kind of like writes and presents things, because I think it's easy to get caught up in your bubble, and for a scientist or you're in this field, like there are things that are self-evident, but you still have to kind of sell it. And I think like you see it with wine too, but like in the idea of like there are things that are bread and butter, there are things that are popular, there are things that appeal to people, and that's okay, and you need that, because you are a part, I mean, you're really an outgrowth of the government, and the government's taxing people, and you need to sell them on it. You can't just kind of go off into your ivory tower and do what you think matters. And it's kind of, again, what we said before, we're all part of it, and as big as your team is, it's really kind of a bigger part of a bigger team, which is the country and the various people and politicians. And it seems to be, while it might be frustrating once you accept it, it's probably more gratifying when you see that you're just a part of this even larger organism. Like you're saying, like it's all about the people. And I find sometimes with like my kids, I always find that I'm disappointed to hear that they never like their science classes. And it bothers me, because there are things like as an adult, you think about things, it's like you're so dazzled by the things that just seem so obvious, but that are just absolutely like amazing and exciting. And I find that they don't get that like spark of excitement. Like to me, it's almost like you get distracted by all the technology, the information, and how complicated it is. And what like Neil deGrasse Tyson does is more kind of just like it lights the spark in the human to be excited about what else is out there.
Yeah. Bringing back the wonder is so important. And I agree. The science classes were not my favorites in school. Like I said, it was English and history were really the things that I enjoyed the most. I did appreciate aspects of my science classes, but in general, the connection between what you were doing and the bigger picture was almost always lost on me, at least. And if it was lost on me, I expect it's lost on many people. Let's just put it that way. I know I'm not unusual. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So I don't understand exactly how I ended up here and have been successful, because really, by all rights, if I'm not a physician, I mean, I didn't even know what an engineer was when I was in a kid. So just a very, very different version of science was presented to me personally. And I already was somebody who was, you know, whose family dealt with science. So for those who don't at all, it's gotta be just terrible, the science classes, because really it just feels like a procedure, something you're doing and you don't know why. The why is hard to bring back. I appreciate for sure that Neil deGrasse Tyson, following in his advisor's footsteps, you know, he was a Carl Sagan student. So he comes from a line of science communicators, which is pretty great.
Yeah. The one of the things that I find interesting, even talking about science, and I think that like in this day and age, people kind of feel like there's there's like a truth, like there's hard facts and they're indisputable. And I think you see even a lot of like the conflict in politics in terms of people, it has to be this way, it has to be that way. And I guess you're in a realm where you have like you are looking for objective facts. You're looking for things that are hard and fast. But what I find interesting is even in that context, people, our sense of the world has changed so much over centuries. Like if you think back to what people thought the universe was like 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago, and how much things have changed even in the last 150 years once we could fly. And, you know, we get a new telescope that's going out there now, and we're going to see a different universe than the one we saw. So even in the realm of science, where facts and equations and things are need to be so firm, it's actually kind of humbling and I think somewhat comforting to realize that, you know, we're all struggling with trying to figure out this universe, and you know what, and it's going to continue to evolve. And I think the exciting thing when you think about the future is like we don't even know what we don't know.
That is very, very true. I think so. This whole pandemic has shown us that there's been an evolution of understanding what's going on. Originally, we didn't even understand if contagiousness was, or the contagion was, spread through surfaces or spread through respiratory, through droplets. So I know my family was washing down our groceries, and I have extended family members who were bringing the mail into the garage and then picking up yesterday's mail. So it had sat for a day, you know, and reading today, yesterday's mail, and letting today's mail sit for tomorrow. So because we didn't understand how much was on the surfaces, how much of the contagion would be transmitted by touch versus through respiratory you know, droplets and so forth. So science evolves. We have an evolving understanding. We put forth a hypothesis and we test that and we see if that makes sense. And if it doesn't, then we change the story. We change how it's put together. And you have to be open to an evolving understanding of what's around you, and be open to listening and coming in with new information in order to really understand things. So being closed off from new information is unfortunate, in my opinion, because it really leaves you out of the loop of wonder.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing that I find most comforting when I think about traits that I would want to have is like just the idea of kind of curiosity. I think it like it solves so much if you try to be curious. And I mean, the pandemic, obviously, there's lots of things. And I always kind of felt like, look, this is once in a century type thing. And the last century this happened, we didn't have the scientific capacity. So I tried to kind of go with the flow as much as we could, understanding that things might change and like, yeah, they might get this wrong, but they're learning as we go. And I think I've got to think that's partly the source of the frustration, I'm sure, for some people is like, you said this and now you're saying this and you guys don't know what you're talking about. And it's like, you're kind of seeing how the sausage is made a little bit, I would think.
Exactly. Exactly. I think you are. But I think living in a spirit of growth is really important. I think living in a way such that you're constantly learning and evolving, to me, that's what keeps you young. That's what keeps you going. My big additional skill this pandemic was that I learned how to make yeast bread, sourdough bread. And I have had a starter now that I have fed every single week going on 2 years, I believe. And every week I make sourdough bread, and it took me a while to figure it out. Now I've got it down, and my family is okay that I give bread to our neighbors and give bread to other people, because otherwise it's a lot. So, but it's been super fun to try to figure out how to, what's the formula, what's the set of things that work to make the bread actually rise so that it's got a nice crunchy crust, and but that the inside is not so dense and that it's sour enough, because my family likes it really sour. So how can I do that? And it's been, and what kind of flour? I mean, all these different things, all these different ingredients come together. It's been, that's my new pandemic skill, I will say.
It sounds like, I mean, you have the science part of that is probably very intriguing to you, but then I guess there's the next level, which is like the art of it, which must
right,
be fun as well.
Exactly. And really I've done the experimentation and the reading to see how I can make it better. But when it comes down to it, you just have to try things. You try them. And when it doesn't work, well, the chickens get the bread that time.
Well, it sounds like between being in rural part of the country, being into yeast and having animals and being a specialist in geology, I mean, you've checked a lot of boxes to get into the wine business, by the way.
That sounds good. All right. And actually, that's where you and I connected over, which is that's been a hobby, I suppose, of my husband's and mine, which is that we love trying different varietals from around the country and around the world. And we've just really enjoyed that aspect of travel. For us, travel usually involves drinking wine of some kind.
And do you have any favorite places in California that you either like to go to, or that you have some kind of club membership or something?
So we have recently got into warm weather wines, so like Spanish and Portugal varietals. And in California, there's a county called Amador. It's just east of Sacramento. And it is not as built up or as fancy as Napa and Sonoma, but it also has prices that are better than Napa and Sonoma. And the wines are approachable and really drinkable. And it's been fun to try Tempranillo and Rioja and all of those warm weather wines that you don't get as much of in certainly in Napa, certainly in Sonoma, really. So we've enjoyed exploring that region recently.
I worked now with a winery called Lava Cap in that area. And then we, before that, I worked with one called Terre Rouge, which was owned by a guy named Bill Easton. And those were, I don't know if you encountered those, but the wines were always so good and such good values for the prices.
Absolutely. Some delicious bottles come from those places for sure.
Yeah. So I feel like we could go another hour talking about wine and other things, but we should probably let you get on to your actual job. Is there life out there? I'm sure you're asked that all the time, but what's your hunch?
I believe there is life out there. I think that they are very far away. I don't think that they have contacted us, but I hope someday we'll find them, or they will find us.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the last thing, just in closing, I think there's a lot out there that if you just turn on the news, that makes you kind of feel down on things. And I've been trying to think more about, I think, all the reasons for hope for myself. But like for you, what wakes you when you wake up in the morning or you're getting through your day? What are your sources of hope to kind of get through and do all the hard work and make the sacrifices that you're making?
I will say that I think this next generation, the Gen Z, I feel that they have a good understanding of what really matters, and they are vocal enough and are interested in continuing to try to make this world better. And they give me a lot of hope.
That's great. All right. Well, Deborah, thank you so much for joining me and having a chat and teaching so much about this stuff and just getting to know each other more. So
thank you
very much, and have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you so much, Michael, for having me on today.
All right. Thank you, Deborah. Take care.